celebrating aircraft home building and innovation. This is EAA Radio in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Hello, EAA. Good morning. This is Fast Eddie, and I'm here with the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum's president, Russ Strine. Good morning, Russ.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
I'm good. Russ, the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum has embarked upon a very special project. Let's talk about that project. What are you guys doing that separates you from everybody else?
Well, in 1980, we found a Northrop P-61 Black Widow. That's a World War II night fighter, first purpose-built aircraft for night fighting. We found this airplane on top of a mountain in West Irian, Indonesia. That's on the island of New Guinea. It crashed during World War II during an orientation flight. Nobody was killed in the accident. The plane was just deemed inaccessible and was left there for 45 years. So we heard about the airplane and set about to recover it.
Well, Russ, that brings a big question. Why a P-61?
I really don't know. Here on the East Coast, warbirds were just kind of heating up, if you will, at air shows. There weren't many warbird air shows around at that time here in the East. And when I was a kid, we lived in Maryland just outside of Silver Hill, where the Smithsonian's Garber facility is. And they had a P-61 there, and it sat outside covered under tarps. And I don't know, I just always looked at that airplane and lusted about it. My father had an interest in Silver Hill there, and we were able to get into the Garber facility quite often, and I would always go and look at the P-61, and I knew that it was a rare bird. So when the opportunity came along, we said, sure, why not?
Well, how did you guys find out about this airplane?
My father was flying as a co-pilot on a B-25, and they were at an air show. Another air crew were talking one night with my dad, and it was one of those things, you know, you're out, you're having a beer, and they were telling these so-called war stories. Well, I know where this airplane is. Well, I know where that airplane is. And the subject of this P-61 came up. My dad followed up on it and asked for the information. We got it complete with pictures and went to work on it from there.
Well, there must have been something between the negotiations with the government of New Guinea, not to mention the logistics of actually retrieving the aircraft.
Well, the negotiations were interesting. The first thing that we had to determine was who owned it. Did the United States Air Force still own it? Did the Indonesians own it? And through research, we found out that by the signing of the treaties that ended World War II, paragraph in there that said that all war trash belonged to the country and where it rested. So the P-61 clearly belonged to the Indonesians, not the Air Force. We got a letter from an Air Force office in the Pentagon saying that, in fact, they didn't own the airplane. The Indonesians did. And that letter was like magic. It allowed us to present it to the Indonesians and go from there. Job still wasn't over, however. We had to determine some sort of a cultural exchange for the airplane. The Indonesians wanted something, but they didn't know what they wanted. Ultimately, after a couple of years of negotiation, we traded them a flying steerman for their Air Force Museum in return for the P-61. So now we had an agreement, and we had to get it off of that mountain. To do that, we had to disassemble it. We had to find a way to get it off. We tried negotiating with oil companies that do oil exploration in that area that have helicopters capable of doing the lift. We ultimately ended up getting Palit Air Service, which is a quasi-government arm of the Indonesians. They flew a Puma helicopter, it's an SA-330 Puma, from the west end of the island archipelago there. It's 25,000 islands or so that make up Indonesia. They flew the airplane about 3,000 miles to come do the lifting job. So it took them a week in flying the helicopter to the site. And then it took them about a week to do the lifting, and it was disassembled at that point where we could lift the fuselage pod, the left inner wing, the right inner wing, the left engine, the right engine, and so forth. We did it in pieces like that because the density altitude was such that that's all the helicopter could lift.
That sounds like an extraordinary experience. And now the airplane you'd said had been sitting in the jungle for 45 years. Pretty much it was all overgrown by then.
Well, we actually went to look at the airplane. Now, keep in mind, we first heard about it in 1980. Now it's Thanksgiving of 1984, and we finally got an invite to go look at the airplane. So we had native guides take us up the mountain, a party of five or six of us, and we were astonished. Yes, the airplane was overgrown with moss, but it still had air in the tires, brand new tires, by the way. It had air in the tires, it had oil in the engines, it had hydraulic fluid in it, and much of the airplane was still like new. We determined that it was very restorable. It had landed on a rock outcrop, and hitting those rocks kept the belly out of the mud for 45 years, and therefore there wasn't a lot of corrosion.
Well, that's a lucky break. Corrosion is one of the worst things to have to repair on an airplane. So now that you've got your airplane, what was it like to actually take the thing apart?
Well, we weren't rich people. We're still not. We got our members to support us. We went over in about seven different expeditions. Each round trip cost us about $30,000. We had to take the airplane apart as best we could. You know, there were 40-year-old bolts that were stubborn. Well, we had to cut the wing bolts, for instance. Mind you, we didn't want to destroy any part of the airplane, but we did have to cut the wing bolts. We did that using hacksaws wrapped with electrical tape and masking tape, and we went through hundreds of hacksaw blades, I can tell you, in cutting those bolts. So it was very tedious, very time-consuming. The airplane was on a 55-degree incline, so you had to tie yourself onto it so you didn't fall off. So through about six expeditions, we got the airplane taken apart. Then they had to cut trees down in a three-acre area on the mountain so that the helicopter could come in and have clearance for his rotor blades to work. And they used the trunks of those trees to build a small heliport that was used as a staging area. The parts could be put onto there, and they were either slinging them or netting them. It was also used for the helicopter to offload its crew chief and other rigging personnel. So it was quite an undertaking.
Well, the airplane has gone through quite a transition from being plucked off the side of a mountain in New Guinea to how she's sitting now. She's actually on her landing gear again.
We got the airplane home in April 1991. While we were waiting for it to come home, interestingly, by the way, it was in 15 crates in five sea containers, and it cost us $54,000 alone just for the sea freight. So it came home in April 91. Meanwhile, we were busy building fixtures to hold the various parts, like inner nacelles or inner wings, as you want to call them, fuselage, tails, etc. So they were built out of heavy steel, ready to accept the airplane once it came out of the crate. So that was the very beginning. And we started on the fuselage pod. It's been a pretty daunting task, to tell you the truth. Over the years, raised money as we could through our members and through fund drives. And we work on the airplane every day. It's now assembled. The fuselage is complete. The inner wings are complete. It's sitting on its landing gear. We had a big rollout for that here last year. We now have both of the tail booms complete, as are the fins. Presently, we're finishing up the horizontal stabilizer. We expect to mount that all this winter. After the first of the year, we'll be starting on the wings. That's the last thing we've got to go yet.
So you've come a long way, and you're about 90% done with about 90% to go then.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you're never done. And people ask us all the time, Ed, when's that airplane going to be finished? We've got to the point we just say Tuesday.
Well, Russ, one thing that interests me, have you had any help from Northrop on this airplane?
Yes, we did. We tried to interest them to get involved and become a historical sponsor, being that they were the manufacturer of the airplane. And most of their income today is based on military contracting. Shipbuilding, actually, is their largest single source of revenue. They did give us some logistical support in the way of aircraft drawings. We got a complete set of microfilm for the airplane from them. But aside from that, not too much support.
Well, hopefully they'll change their mind when they see it in the air.
You never know. They've got, obviously, manufacturing capabilities, and we'd hoped that we could get spars machined by them. I guess they're not interested in the liability, and in today's environment, I certainly understand that. So we've worked around it, and, you know, as I said, we work on the airplane every day and coming along quite well.
Well, Russ, have you been able to locate any of the actual crew of the airplane?
Well, the pilot died in 1968. The only other crew member that was aboard was the radar operator. He lives out in Corona Del Mar, California, is of the persuasion that he's tired of hearing about war, and so he didn't even want to talk about it. I guess they got in a little trouble for crashing the airplane, and it's some bad memories for him, and he just doesn't want to get involved, unfortunately. We have been in contact with pilot's widow and also his daughter, who's been extremely interested in the airplane over the years. So that's interesting. We've also been in close contact, and they've been huge supporters of the project, and that's the World War II Night Fighters. And 550th Squadron is the one that this airplane was assigned to, and so the 550th members have strongly supported the project, as have the rest of the Night Fighters. They've given us historical accounts of how the crash occurred and who was aboard. And
well, the other thing I've noticed, looking at the airplane itself, there's a lot of plexiglass in this thing. Undoubtedly, it was all destroyed in the crash or wiped out over the ages. What did you do to get new plexi for this thing?
Once we got the canopy structures back in place and we had drawings, and we went ahead and made our own molds and made our own ovens, and a lot of the simple window panes we made ourselves right here in our shops. The big teardropped bubble that's on the back, the radar operator's observation bubble, we had LP Aeroplastics out in Jeanette, Pennsylvania, who makes aircraft windshields for a living. We had them, we made the mold and took it to them and had them bend and assemble that glass. But otherwise, we've done it all right here in our own shops.
Everything that you have done on this airplane has been done in-house. That's just fantastic.
We decided that we wanted to put new spars in both of the inner wings. We'll do that in the outer wings as well. And I think it only was good sense for safety, because we do intend to fly this airplane. We did have to outsource machining of those spars, but everything else has been done in-house.
That is a testament to the membership and the staff and crew here that you have working on this airplane. It takes a lot of talent to take something from a wreck and restore it back to flying capabilities again. Did you ever get the feeling that maybe you were in over your head a little?
You know, it's like anything else. This thing has consumed about 30 years of my family's life. My father is now 87 and still works every day, is still here. He runs our shop and is in charge of the restoration. And of course, you know, I'm president of the museum and I'm here every day, and I'm charged with making sure that the ink is black all the time. There are days when, you know, you're having a bad day and you say, geez, I wish I never saw that darn thing. And then there are other days that I'm extremely proud of what my family has done, what our members have done over the years. And really, in retrospect, the P-61 has truly put the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum on the map, on a worldwide sense. We get emails and calls literally every day about the P-61, somebody new that has heard about it, even though it's been out there for a long time. People are discovering it every day, and that's really gratifying.
Well, it just goes to show that the eye of the world truly is looking upon you.
They are.
The publicity that you can generate for this aircraft is a good thing. And if people want to find out more about the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum and the P-61, where can they go?
Well, we have a great website. All you need to type in is MAM. You don't even need to type in www.maam.org. Just type in MAAM and it'll pop up. It's a great website that's been put together. And you can see our aircraft collection. And, you know, we missed an interesting step here in the story. Yes, we started out this museum to acquire this P-61. Well, in the meantime, over the last 30 years, the collection has grown to 77 aircraft.
Oh, my aching eyes.
We've got about 32 of them restored and on display here in Redding. The others are here in storage. We've got about four projects going on at any one time, the P-61 being obviously the biggest and the most prioritized. But we've put a great organization together. You can join it just like you can become an EAA member. You can become a Mid-Atlantic Air Museum member. But as I said, we have a great website. You can go on there and click on the Widow's Web, and you can see hundreds of pictures of the restoration over the last however many years, progress we've made, and you can take it from there.
Sounds like an excellent website, but the P-61 isn't the only thing that has put Mid-Atlantic Air Museum on the map. You also do one of the premier air show and reenactor events, World War II Weekend.
Yes, 19 years ago, we set out to do something different in the way of air shows, and we called it World War II Weekend, and we didn't want it to be an aerobatic flip-flop type air show, although there's nothing wrong with them. They're great. We just were looking to create our own unique niche, so we established World War II Weekend, and we tried it that first year, and it went over great. It's always the first weekend of June, and we just completed our 19th consecutive event. Next year, of course, is the 20th anniversary. We're looking to do a big blowout and have a lot of the aircraft that we've done over the years back. We've grown. We have 1,500 reenactors. We have 80-some military vehicles. We've had 80-some aircraft here this year. It's just a huge event. We've got one of the largest military collector flea markets in existence, I think. And it's something that has generated a loyal following and has just been great as far as keeping the museum going.
It certainly does focus the interest and keeps the people coming back. And, of course, when they come back, they see the P-61 every year. And, like me, they're just blown away by the progress of this thing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And as you've recognized, it's a lot of work. And, you know, nothing's free, as they say. You got to put time and effort into it to make it as all these airplanes here at EAA. So we're no different.
Well, Russ, one other question for you here. The P-61 was a radar-guided night fighter, correct?
Yes.
Okay. The radar set. Now, I was looking in the, I guess it would be the radar operator's compartment there on the end of the airplane, and I saw a lot of equipment back there. Is that equipment going to be restored to operating status, too, or is that just physically restored?
Well, unfortunately, the band that the radar operated on is no longer legal today. I believe it's a X-band radar, and there's nothing on that. We are going to make it operational as far as the set being able to rotate, but it's not going to be able to transmit and receive.
That's a good thing, I guess. You don't want to get in trouble with the FCC.
No, I suspect it probably could get a special or a provisional license, but it's not like a weather radar. It's a target radar. And that would be kind of neat, actually. We'd have our own little TCAS, so to speak.
Yes, you would. Speaking of that, how has the FAA been with the restoration of this aircraft?
Just wonderful. We've had all the cooperation we could ever ask for, and it's just gone along smooth.
Well, that's good to hear. Well, the one thing that I'd like to personally see is I don't want to be out here on the maiden voyage, but I'd love to be out here when you turn the engines on that for the first time.
Well, God willing, I hope that I'm the guy that's going to be able to do that. I'm looking forward to my first flight. You know, I've been the pilot of our B-25 briefing time for 30 years now.
Wow.
And I think I've figured out how many hours it flew during World War II, and I think I've been through about 5 World War IIs with it.
Oh, geez.
The total time that I've flown it. The systems on the P-61, it's an interesting airplane. It's what I like to call a borrowed airplane. When this thing went on the drawing boards, it was a hot project. It had to get in the air in a hurry. So they went around, I think, looking for components that were already on the shelf. Literally, this airplane is a B-25 as far as its systems go. The Bendix landing gear is actually a B-25 landing gear just turned around backwards. The hydraulic system is identical to a B-25. For me, it's going to be a very familiar feeling airplane.
Well, that sounds like you're going to have a lot of fun when you first break ground with that airplane. You're figuring to have it in the air within, what, the next 5 years maybe?
Yes, within the next 5 years. I think sooner than that, actually. You just never know. You never know what you're going to run into.
The engines. I'm assuming that you are not going to be able to restore them to flight status.
Well, we have the engines. They're Pratt & Whitney R2800-65s. They're a little bit unique. They've got a low blower, a high blower, and a neutral blower position. Put out 2,100 horsepower for takeoff with water injection. We have those engines. They are restorable or rebuildable, however you want to say it. But I think that with all of the service bulletins and airworthiness directives that were issued since the war years on those engines, it would be probably not economical. Certainly, it would be a historical phenomenon to have those original engines on the airplane. But I think it is not economically feasible.
It also might be a safety issue, too.
Well, nobody's going to restore an engine, something we won't do in-house. They'll get sent out. But nobody's going to restore an engine that's unsafe.
Exactly.
So I don't think that that is an issue at all. We do have one engine. We found in the process and over the years, we've run across a lot of P-61 parts that we've added to our little stable here, one being a complete QEC that we found in Fargo, North Dakota, for a P-61. Hmm. Here was this thing, you know, QEC is engine mount forward, including the cowlings, complete engine ready to bolt onto an airplane, brand new.
Wow.
The downside about that engine is that its gaskets would be dried out, and so really it needs to come apart and have a condition inspection at the very least, and new gaskets put in it. But more than likely a complete overhaul. I think it would be a very inexpensive overhaul, but nonetheless an overhaul. So we've yet to get to the second engine yet. Whether we decide to use one of the original engines or procure another one, I don't know yet.
Well, that's a long way off. Well, maybe not that long.
No, I don't think it's that long.
You never know, Russ. Christmas might come early. With the internet being what it is, you never know what you're going to find when you start looking on eBay.
Just in April, I got an email and a photograph from a guy in California. Says, can you identify this spinner? And I looked at it, and immediately looking at it, I knew that it was a P-61 spinner. And he gave the dimensions. It's this round. It's this tall. It's got holes for four blades. So we had one P-61 spinner that we got years ago with a group of other spare parts. So I went and measured, and sure enough, it was a P-61 spinner. So I made a deal to purchase it, and it's here now. Stuff like that comes our way all the time. It's amazing. We had an individual call us right after we got the airplane home, and he says, I've collected a bunch of spare parts for P-61. Congratulations on getting the airplane home. Would you like to have these parts? I'm interested in selling them, and nobody else needs them but you. And I said, yes, we're interested. How much? And I thought, oh, God, you know, sit down. Here it comes. The guy could have put any number on it he wanted. He said, how's $12,000? There were 568 different parts.
Wow.
Engine mounts. Landing gear doors, gun bay doors, tail booms, cowlings, all of the items that we needed to repair this airplane, a fire bomber had collected. So one of these fire bomber operators had collected all these parts in case he ever put one of these airplanes in on its belly. And they went through the airplanes, totaling them, destroying them, and he had these parts left. So another individual acquired them and was sitting on them, and all of a sudden here's a buyer. So he was very fair to us, selling us those parts for that kind of money.
It sounds like a really good deal. You just never know what people are sitting on anymore.
You never know what's out there.
Well, Russ, once again, we want to steer people to your website, which is?
www.maam.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Russ Strine, president of the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum, and we've been talking about their P-61 Black Widow. And you're listening to EAA Radio.